Early yesterday, but we have our governing board meeting, and the good news is I wasn't fired, and so I'm glad to hear you. A lot of you played with the Kerr metric in the afternoon, and somebody I think asked me, well, people are asking, how on earth did this person discover this solution? That's actually a very interesting puzzle. I mean, and many people ask it. How could we derive the solution? And that's an interesting Psi project for anyone who wants to think about it. In fact, there are many interesting puzzles to do with the Kerr metric, one of which is, and I'm not an expert on this, I should warn you, but one of them is, so for example, with Schwarzschild, you can find a solution. The Schwarzschild is a good exterior solution for a star. And if you now put in some matter, and for example, put the matter at constant pressure, okay, so just put P equals constant. Pick some equation of state for the matter. You just pick the pressure to be anything you like, pick it to be a constant. You can find an exact solution for the interior which matches onto Schwarzschild on the exterior. Okay, so this is a solved problem. In fact, there are many examples of exact solutions for the interior of a star with some assumed type of matter. But at least as far as I know, for Kerr, there is no solution which is known, which is an interior solution. So even if your star is bigger than this ergosphere, right, so there's none of the funny business, you're just dealing with the exterior, as far as I know, there's no exact solution for the interior. So that's also would be a fun Psi project to try and find such a solution. Okay, so there are many, many things that have not been done with... Not known.
There is room because the equations are nonlinear.
Yeah, definitely nonlinear.
Yeah. And the proper match was not found.
Right. That's right.
But people believe that such solution exists.
Yeah, we can see them. We see rotating stars. I mean, they occur. Just a star with angular momentum is a Kerr solution. So there must be. The point, I mean, you can find numerical solutions, but they're not analytical solutions known. So even that, there are many interesting problems to do with this. And then people study the stability. You can take Kerr with small perturbations. Put that in the Einstein equations and see if it's stable. They are proven to be, Kerr metric is known to be stable to small fluctuations. But there are actually many open problems relating to Kerr. So last time I derived two important surfaces, okay, two event horizons. There was, these are both null surfaces, though I'm drawing them in this x. So I defined x, y, and z. X was square root, what was x? X was the square root of r squared plus a squared sine theta cos phi. Y was square root of r squared plus a squared sine theta sine phi. Z was r cos theta. And then we're sketching we're sketching everything in the xz plane. And so I'm just taking phi to be 0. And so I'm kind of drawing the cross section of the black hole. And so this, the first thing was an ellipse. Or ellipsoid, because it's really a surface of revolution. I should think of taking this and rotating it around the z-axis to get the full solution. Yep?
You say that Kerr metric is stable. What
yep.
do you mean by that? Can you determine the metric? Mass angle of the
metric? No, so if I say g mu nu equals g mu nu Kerr plus h mu nu, where h is a small fluctuation, And then I go and I calculate the Einstein equations, R mu nu equals zero, including this H. Okay? And then I get some linearized equation, some operator times H equals zero. Okay? That equation, now I look at this and I try to find the eigenmodes. And these will be the gravitational waves in this background. And if you find a mode which goes like e to the I omega t, in other words, if it's oscillatory, that's a wave. But if it's exponential, e to some alpha t, that's an instability. And the statement is the curvimetric is stable. There are no unstable modes, just oscillatory modes.
Even if alpha is negative?
No, that's alpha positive, thanks. Alpha negative would be fine. But of course, the equation is time reversal invariant, so in fact, the metric is, actually, no, it's not. I'm sorry, you're not. I should have made this point. The Kerr metric is not time reversal invariant, right? Because time reversal is t goes to minus t. But notice that this term changes sign. But you see, all that happens is I'm changing the angular momentum to the opposite angular momentum. So it's equivalent. So if there was a mode going like this for, then there must be the other one, but for a black hole with the opposite angular momentum. But those two are equivalent. So yeah, it's still true. This would be bad if you found a mode like this. So this is a big sort of industry is actually looking at neutron stars and spinning neutron stars and so on and trying to find, do they have instabilities, usually including matter, to see if these are solutions that would persist. Okay, so I derived last time two event horizons. Okay, and remember we saw the condition for an R equals constant surface to be null was actually very simple. It was just that GRR was zero. The metric, the RR component of the raised metric was zero. And there were two solutions to that, R minus and R plus. And so R plus and minus were these two things. Kind of like the Schwarzschild. One is like the Schwarzschild radius squared minus a squared. Okay, and you can check this makes sense because if a is zero, then angular momentum is zero, then Kerr is Schwarzschild. And here we have gm over c squared plus or minus gm over c squared. So the outer event horizon of Kerr becomes the Schwarzschild horizon, 2gm over c squared, and the inner one is singular in the limit as a goes to zero. So these were event horizons, and that means that nothing can escape from inside R plus, right? Nothing can escape to infinite radius if it's inside R plus, because even light cannot get out of an event horizon. So now this time I'm going to discuss a kind of more interesting surface, which I just mentioned last time, which actually touches this surface at the north and the south pole. And this surface is the boundary of the ergosphere. Okay, so the ergosphere is bounded by this outer orange surface and the outer event horizon. And this surface is often called the stationary limit. So let's call it RSL, stationary limit. Stationary limit means that if I go inside that surface, I cannot remain stationary. Okay? I can remain stationary outside the black hole, okay, by having a rocket with an appropriate, I point my rocket booster in the appropriate direction, I can just sit there. Right? Like I'm above the sun and I'm falling into the sun, but I turn the rockets on and I resist gravity and I just stay stationary. Okay? If you're inside the ergosphere, there is no rocket powerful enough to keep you stationary. You have no option but to go around with the black hole. Okay? We say this phenomenon is called dragging of inertial frames. Okay? The inertial frames inside the ergosphere are dragged around in a sense, in a certain sense, faster than the speed of light. Okay? So not even light can go backwards against the flow of the inertial frame. Okay, it's really extreme, and so I'll show this. That's why you know, certain bizarre things can happen. So the first of all is, let me just show you why it's called a stationary limit surface. It's the surface on which GTT is zero. Okay, so. GTT is this quantity here. And so what we get is rho squared is equal to 2gm r over c squared. And so what this means is that r squared plus a squared cos squared theta is 2gmr over c squared. And so I can rewrite this as r stationary limit minus gm over c squared squared is gm over c squared minus this is squared. Okay, so I'm just comparing this equation with that. Compare this to the outer event horizon, which is just gm over c squared squared minus a squared. Okay, so if I take the outer event horizon minus gm over c squared and square it, I just get this stuff in the square root. But if I take the stationary limit surface minus gm over c squared and square it, I get the same quantity, but a bit it's a bit larger. Okay, so obviously RSL is greater than R plus, except that theta equals 0. And if you remember, theta equals 0 is just the z-axis in these coordinates, because theta equals 0, x and y are 0. And so this line here is, this is theta equals 0. Okay, so why does that have the physical meaning that I explained, GTT being zero? Well, that's very easy to see, because for a massive particle, right, we have to have g mu nu x dot nu equal to minus 1. Okay? And what is that equal to? Well, that's equal to GTT, T dot squared, plus 2GT phi T dot phi dot, plus all the other terms. Okay, so in this case, we have things like GRR, R dot squared, plus dot dot dot. Okay, so this combination has to be minus 1. Now, what I see from this is that if GTT equals 0, okay, let's say greater than or equal to 0, if GT is either positive or 0, then there is no solution. No solution for theta dot equals phi dot equals r dot equals 0. So stationary means it's sitting at fixed coordinate r, theta, and phi. That's what stationary means. Okay? And that means that theta dot, phi dot, and r dot are 0. But if they're 0, then the only non-zero term in this expression is gtt t dot squared. But if gtt is positive, then you're out of luck. It's just impossible to have a particle satisfying this equation. Okay, so the only resolution of this is that for gtt greater than 0, we must have a moving particle. The particle must move. Okay, and what in fact happens is that phi dot, phi becomes something like a time. You see, what's happening is that the rotation here, the spinning nature of the space-time is mixing up time with angle, phi. And as you spin faster, this off-diagonal element in the metric becomes bigger and bigger. That part of the metric, the t phi part of the metric, always has signature minus 1, 1, in the sense it always has one negative and one positive eigenvalue. Okay? Outside the, because the space-time's not singular there. There's no singularity anywhere. Okay, so there's always one positive, one negative eigenvalue, but it's just that a mixture of t and phi becomes the time-like coordinate. Okay, t alone is not time-like. Obviously, gtt has changed sign. So t alone looks space-like. But the correct time coordinate is a mixture between t and phi. And so if a particle is time-like, it has to move, at least in phi. So that's what happens when you get into the ergosphere. You cannot stay stationary in these coordinates. There are other things, interesting things that happen, and I mentioned this last time, that RSL is also the infinite redshift surface. Okay, so other properties. R equals RSL is also the infinite redshift surface, okay, meaning that as something falls into that surface, then an observer at infinity receiving radiation from that surface will see it shift to the red by an infinite amount. So as you fall into the surface, you will go redder and redder, longer and longer wavelengths will be seen coming out of you, until your luminosity goes to zero and people just lose sight of you. Okay, and that just follows directly from the fact GTT goes to zero. I think I derived that earlier. There's another interesting point, which is, imagine you see this hole is spinning like mad and dragging the inertial frames. And this dragging goes up to the speed of light as I cross this surface. So another physical manifestation of this is that if I imagine emitting a photon, okay, I fall into the black hole and I emit a photon tangential to the ergosphere, okay? Well, if it's going in the same direction as the spin of the hole, the photon will just fly out, no problem. If it is flying against, if it's counter-rotating to the black hole, what do you think happens to the photon? So I sit here, and I emit a photon in the opposite direction to the rotation of the black hole. What happens to the photon? Space is coming past it at the speed of light. It's static. Okay? So if you just put a photon here and send it counter-rotating to the black hole, it just stays there. Okay? So I'll just leave that as an exercise. A null ray sent from a point on the equator of the ergosphere, equator of the stationary limit, I should say, actually. Equator of the stationary limit surface. In a direction opposite to the rotation of the hole, just stays at fixed phi. Okay, so you can literally just hold light there forever at the same place. That's a nice thing to do. Okay. So that's easy to check. Just write down the null condition for the geodesic to be null, and write down that it's only moving in the phi and t directions, and just see there is a solution. Yep. Yeah, that's right. The person is a massive particle, so the massive particle can't stay still. Only the light can stay still. You know, you would emit the photon, and you are sucked around with the black hole at the speed of light. Okay. So, yeah.
So, are you saying that for the observer at infinity, it looks like the light ray has zero velocity?
Observer at infinity can't see anything.
Well, but that's what we're talking
we're about. We're on the infinite redshift surface. So the observer at infinity can't see anything on the infinite redshift surface.
But we're solving this metric.
There's a subtle difference between seeing and observing.
So the observer at infinity observes
the light ray is stationary. Yeah. So the observer at infinity, when asked to say, where is the light ray? Okay, it was emitted. What coordinate is the light ray? The observer at infinity would be the light ray is at phi equals zero for all time. Just sits there. Okay. All right, so it's quite bizarre. Okay, but now we're going to do the...
O'Neill?
Yep. Yep.
So is this what we mean by the frame grabbing?
Yes.
You see, because the observer at the infinity is not inertial with respect to this system, that's why it can observe the photon as static. So the actual inertial frames are going...
Yes, right? Yes. Yeah. And in a sense, they're going faster than the speed of light inside the ergosphere. So, okay. So now I want to show you maybe the most bizarre thing of all. You see, so this discovery of Kerr solution actually raised these properties for the first time. People hadn't anticipated them. And it led to many, many things. It led to this kind of bizarre realization that, you know, black holes are really pretty strange objects. It also, over time, over the 1960s, led to the laws of black hole thermodynamics, which you've heard of, the area theorems you may have heard of, black hole area is like its entropy. It led to the theory of Hawking radiation and all these developments. But they were kind of stimulated by rather, you know, simple calculations, which in principle or in hindsight maybe, which came out of this Kerr metric. So I'm just going to show you the final kind of bizarre property of Kerr, which I mentioned last time, the Penrose process, that I can, if a spaceship falls into the black hole and drops a particle through the event horizon, the spaceship can emerge with more energy than it went in. Okay, and you're extracting the energy from the black hole in this process. Actually, you're extracting the energy from the rotation of the black hole. The mass of the black hole will never decrease, just the rotation, just the angular momentum. So just to keep things simple, I didn't find this derived in any textbook, though they mention it, but they don't really justify it. So I thought it would be fun to try. Let's just write the TT and T phi part of the metric like that. Okay, I'm just defining A, B, and C to be these coefficients. And I've put my factor of 2 here, just which is the same as writing it that way. Now, the point is, let's imagine we've got this particle falling in the Kerr metric. Okay, so it's solving a geodesic equation. Our spaceship is just, forget about the rockets on the spaceship. Let's just switch the rockets off, and so the spaceship falls into the black hole. The question is, what is the conserved energy? Okay, so you remember when I showed you the geodesic equation, I explained that if the metric is independent of any coordinate, then the corresponding momentum is conserved. Okay, so which coordinates is this metric independent of? Right, obviously depends on theta, depends on r, what are the phi and t, yeah, two coordinates. The conserved energy is the momentum conjugate to T. Okay, that means momentum, remember, is defined to be the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocity. Okay, the momentum has a downstairs index because the velocity has an upstairs index. Should be like that. Okay, and so all that is the following expression. This is the rest mass. So I just take that action which I wrote down for the point particle, and then we've got GTT T dot. Plus other stuff. Plus GT phi dot. Okay, so I've just calculated the partial derivative, right? The Lagrangian had something like this, m over 2 integral g mu nu x dot nu x dot nu. And I've just taken the partial derivative with respect to the velocity of t. And then the statement is that pt dot is 0. Okay, the geodesic equation implies that the time component of the momentum is conserved. So that's actually what we mean by energy. in the Kerr metric. That's the conserved quantity. So I can follow a geodesic all the way from infinity, falling into the black hole, and reemerging. And at infinity, at r equals infinity, gtt is minus 1. And so pt is actually minus the energy. OK, just because gtt is negative. So this conserved quantity has a physical interpretation of minus the energy of the particle at infinity. So now we imagine the following process. Let's take our Kerr black hole. And I'm going to throw I'm going to have a particle number 1 falling into the black hole. This will be 1. And particle number 1 is going to split into 2 particles. 2 will go into the event horizon, and 3 will go off to infinity. Okay? So now the point is that the splitting of the particle is something which happens locally. All right? So it happens in a little region of space-time. And I can always, that little region can always be described as a piece of Minkowski space. Okay, so the splitting involves no gravity at all, and the energy should be conserved. Right, so the rocket is just ejecting some particle, and the energy should be conserved. And so in that process, in the splitting process, we must have PT1 is equal to PT2. Plus PT3. Now, if I know the energy of particle 3, I can just follow it off to infinity, and PT3 is equal to minus the energy of 3 at infinity. So the only real question is, does this PT2, is it positive or negative? Okay, I emitted something. I lost some energy. The energy in this guy equals the energy in this one minus the energy in that one. Have I gained energy or lost energy? Okay. Now, when we do these things in Minkowski space, of course, if you lose some energy, you've lost energy. Energy goes down. But when we do it in the Kerr metric, actually, the energy goes up. Okay? So how much of this do I need? I think I do not need the Kerr metric anymore. Actually, I do need it. Yeah, sorry, I do need it. So I'm just going to write this out. Okay, so I think this whole thing is A. And A is becoming positive inside this thing. This quantity is B. And all this horrible expression is C. So what's happening inside the ergosphere is this is going positive. So what is E2? The energy of particle 2. Well, it's minus PT2. And so that's minus the mass of particle 2 times A T2 dot minus B T phi 2 dot. OK, so I'm just using GT phi. See, B is GT phi. Or minus B is GT phi. So I'm just writing M2 GTT T2 dot plus GT phi dot. Okay, so yeah, and so obviously it looks like since A is positive, I've got a chance of this energy being negative. Okay, so let's actually just work that out. This is negative in the following region. So just graph T2 dot against phi dot. This is a linear quantity. So if it's negative, it just means it's on one side of a line. Okay, this is all negative on one side of a line. And the line, if I did the algebra right, then the line is through the origin. So this line is T2 dot equals B over A phi 2 dot. And I've assumed A is positive. And everywhere on this side of the line, this number is negative. Okay, so on this side of the line, E2 is negative. Now, so it looks like, oh, it's easy to emit a particle with negative energy. It's just got to have some velocity in the t and phi direction up here. Okay, but I've got to check one other thing. I've got to check that the particle actually satisfies g mu nu x dot mu x dot nu is minus 1. Okay, otherwise, it's not a particle, not a massive particle. So we must check that AT2 dot squared minus 2B T2 dot phi dot plus C phi dot squared equals minus 1. Okay, and you see, if A is positive, the only way to satisfy that, A is positive and C is positive, the only way is to satisfy it with this term. So you've got to have that this term is bigger than those two terms. Okay, so what is that? Well, that's just a hyperbola. Okay, this is the equation for a hyperbola. And so all I have to do is draw the hyperbola. Now, the hyperbola is oriented with respect to some axes. And the way to find those, the way to find the kind of center of the hyperbola is just take the limit T2 dot and phi 2 dot go to are large. Okay. Then this is irrelevant. And so essentially, you've got to balance, when you take the magnitude of T2 and phi to be big, you've got to balance these terms against each other. And so you've got to solve that the left-hand side is equal to 0. And essentially, that this is just a quadratic equation, okay, for T2 dot over phi dot. So the asymptotes, so this is a hyperbola, and the asymptotes are T2 dot over phi dot equals B over A plus or minus square root B over A squared minus C over A. Okay, so I'm just solving a quadratic equation for T2 dot over phi dot. And you notice that this value is exactly the same as that value. So what this means is that the hyperbole looked like this. Okay, and so that's, my particle has to live on that hyperbola. Now, there's only one other condition I need to satisfy. It's got to be time-like. It's got to have negative energy. I want to get negative energy. And it also has to be future-pointing. A particle needs to point to the future, right? Its world line should point to the future. Well, I won't tell you which one of these is the future, okay? It lives on one of these two trajectories. One of them has future pointing. I didn't work it out. And luckily, it doesn't matter. Because for either one of them, there are plenty of solutions where I have negative energy. Okay? If this is the future-pointing hyperbola, then I live on this, on that part of the curve, and I've got a future-pointing particle satisfying its condition, and E2 is negative. Okay? So for either case, so we must have, particle must also be future-pointing. One is, one of these is future-pointing, one is past-pointing. Must also, so the particle velocity, particle 4 velocity, x dot mu, must also be future-pointing. And so it must live on one or other of the hyperbola, of the two branches of the hyperbola. And as I said, it doesn't matter which one it is, because I just pick the appropriate one. And you can sort of see from this that phi dot, if it was this one, phi dot would have to be bigger than some value. I mean, the only way to have a physical particle is if the angular velocity is bigger than some value. All right? You're not free to have a physical particle stationary. There's no solution here. So it's got to be moving with the black hole. Okay, so that alone tells you that actually it's got to be this guy. It's got to be moving with the rotation of the black hole. And so that's it. So we've shown that it is possible to emit a particle with negative energy, and then you just follow particle 3 out of the black hole, and it'll come out with some net energy. Okay? When you do this, the emitted particle, there's another constraint which I won't derive, which is that the emitted particle has more angular momentum than the one that goes off to back out to infinity. So I said that the wrong way around. The emitted particle has the sum of the angular momenta of particle 2 and particle 3 will be positive. Okay? So particle 2 has greater angular momentum than particle 3, and with the sum of those two, Lz for particle 2, and also, so I'm not going to derive this, you find that Lz for particle 2 plus Lz of particle 3 has got to be greater than Lz for particle 1. And so this means that the black hole loses momentum to the particles. Do I mean that? I think I only mean this. The emitted particle, only the emitted particle turns out to have greater angular momentum than the one that fell in, so the black hole loses momentum to the particle. Okay, so you can only do this as long as the black hole is spinning, and as you do it, the black hole will slow down and lose its momentum, angular momentum. Okay, any questions about Kerr? We've now, yeah.
Could you, in principle, stop the black hole from spinning by doing this?
Yeah, you could slow it down.
Would you like turn it to a Schwarzschild?
Yeah, it will naturally go to Schwarzschild. As A goes to zero, as the angular momentum goes to zero, it just becomes Schwarzschild.
So is it okay for the singularity to turn from a ring to a point, just like?
Apparently. Apparently. Yeah, that's a kind of smooth process. But actually, I wanted to mention one other thing. Yeah. No, let's take another question. Then I'll draw the conformal diagram for Kerr as the last thing. Yeah.
Sorry, I missed it originally when you were talking about setting up the metric.
Yep.
To the DR and the theta terms.
Sorry, say that again?
The DR and the theta terms. I missed it at the start when you were talking about selecting the metric, where you've just got the...
Oh, why did I drop the DR and the d theta? Yeah, no, good question. I've dropped the DR and d theta because we can always imagine working in the plane theta equals pi over 2. That's always a kind of good thing to do, because if you're in that plane, you never leave it just by symmetry. So let's just stay in that plane, so I can drop the d theta. The DR I'm only really dropping because... doesn't really affect the arguments. Let me see why that is. I mean, what I'm imagining is that when you so we were thinking about particle 2 here. When I send off my particle 2, I'm not sending it in the r direction. I'm just sending it in the theta direction. The phi direction, rather. Okay, that's what I'm doing here. So I'm assuming that x mu 2 dot is equal to t dot 0, 0, phi dot. That's all. And that's kind of with hindsight. I mean, there's in a way nothing interesting in the r direction. So if you include the r direction, no conclusion will change. Clearly, the interesting direction is phi, because it's phi and t which get mixed. Okay, R is a kind of completely normal direction. Even this, you see, well, R is only abnormal when delta changes sign. Then R turns into a time variable. But that's inside the outer event horizon. Okay, the outer event horizon is exactly where this changes sign, but we're still outside there. So this term is positive. So R is just a normal spatial coordinate. In the ergosphere, the only interesting thing is the phi. The mixing between T and phi. Yeah.
So is this what happens naturally? Do we have rotating black holes that evolve to stationary
black holes? No, it's not known. It's not known. Because there's a competition. You see, say you take our black hole at the center of our galaxy, stuff keeps falling into it. But it's pretty unlikely that when it falls in, it emits stuff of negative energy and comes back out, it probably just falls in. And if it falls in, then it may actually be adding angular momentum to the black hole. Okay? So maybe this is kind of sustainable energy, right? You have this black hole there, and these stars keep falling into it in our galaxy, and then we are able to extract the energy from the black hole by doing this. Okay, but there's an endless, well, there's a 10 to the 11 solar masses of the galaxy. We just have to slowly feed more and more of it in such a way that we sustain the angular momentum of the black hole, and then we can extract all the energy in this way. Yeah.
So to get energy up, you have to drop something negative energy in?
No. You drop a positive energy thing in. When it's inside, it emits a positive energy thing in its own Lorentz frame. It emits a completely positive energy thing. So as it performs that emission, its energy... Well, you see, the real statement is the definition of energy is frame dependent. Okay, and now we're talking about energy... Well, the kind of most important property of energy is that it's conserved. Okay, and in this process, we have conserved energy. Okay, The conserved energy is this PT, total. When you do a local process, like a particle splitting into two, you have to conserve that quantity locally. And if you go and calculate in the local Lorentz frame, you'll find nothing funny that a positive energy particle has split into two smaller energy, positive energy particles. But the real thing is that the energy in that local Lorentz frame is not the energy measured by somebody at infinity.
But to us it looks like it.
To us it looks, yeah. It looks to us like this process involved emitting a negative energy particle. Yeah.
So would it take a finite amount of time for the observer outside the black hole for the particle to come back out?
Yes. So what happens is you'll see somebody fall into the event stationary limit surface or infinite redshift surface. You'll see them disappear. Then after some time, they will reappear suddenly somewhere else on the on the infinite redshift surface. And so suddenly they will just burst into appearance, and they'll have more energy. Yeah.
Does this always happen, or so you just said something about like the probability of something emitting a negative energy seems?
Well, yes. No, no. So we had to satisfy these constraints to get it negative energy. So if you're emitting over here, then actually you're emitting things which are positive energy even by the guy at infinity. Okay, so that's not going to give you more energy. So you have to carefully
adjust the thing you adjust.
And I don't intuitively, I don't know which way it goes. I mean, it's probably that you've got to throw something counter-rotating to the black hole. That sort of makes sense, right? I mean, I haven't done the analysis myself, but if you did angular momentum conservation as well, you could figure out, which is the direction of the angular momentum that I need. And intuitively, what you're doing is throwing something against the black hole to reduce its angular momentum. So the final angular momentum of the black hole will be basically what it was initially, plus the angular momentum of the projectile you emitted. And so you emit something with the opposite angular momentum, and that's going to reduce the angular momentum of the black hole. Yeah.
If you have two of those black holes spinning in the same direction, close to each other, so that the Lugosius overlap is, could you then travel safely between them because the angular momentum will cancel each other?
They will merge. So what happens when you put two black holes near each other? They'll attract each other. I mean, gravity is generally attractive. And so if you put the two of them next to each other, then they'll merge into one. And that's the process governed by Hawking's area theorem. That says the area of the final black hole is greater than the sum of the areas of the two initial black holes.
What if they spin oppositely? Is it the same thing happen?
Same thing. I mean, you'll get a Schwarzschild black hole because the angular momentum will cancel. So, I mean, A is the ratio of angular momentum to mass. So if you add two of them, the mass goes up, the angular momentum goes up, probably the A is not so different. It's just the ratio of J to M. And if they're opposite, then they will cancel. So the final angular momentum will be much less than M. Okay. So I think I'm going to move on to a little bit of cosmology, but we have rather little time left. So I have two topics in cosmology I was going to cover, but I think I'd rather just do one, and I'll give you a choice. Okay? So we can either do something more theoretical, which is to derive the equation for the wave function of the universe. Okay, we're basically ready to do that. It's called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is a very puzzling equation, but it's kind of interesting. Or I can just give you an outline of the space of all cosmological solutions to the Einstein equations. I'm actually just writing a paper on this second topic, that it's possible to define a measure on the space of all cosmological solutions of the Einstein equations. So I'm happy to talk about either of these. So let's just have a vote. Who wants to do the wave function of the universe? And who wants to do basic cosmology? That was close, but we have to count. I can come back and do the other one. Later, if people are interested. It may take us an hour, so we could have a 10-minute break and then come back and do both. Do you want to do that? Okay, we'll have a 10-minute break.